You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, good afternoon Auckland, welcome along, should I say, to The Wire with Stuart. It is Tuesday the 12th of February, ko Stuart Soman land toku ing oa. As is kind of usual, it seems to be for me when I start off my show, I'm drinking a coffee that's primarily just milk, but that's, I'm going to try and get through this with less caffeine than I was hoping. Joining me in studio today are my producers Liv and Lisa. How are you two doing?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yep.
Doesn't sound that enthusiastic.
Really good.
Amazing.
That's
never
what I wanted.
Been better.
What's caught your eye in the news in the past week? Anything in particular that you've been following?
I mean, the fires for sure. For sure. It looks pretty hectic down in South Island.
Yeah, two of my flatmates are actually from Nelson.
So wow.
One of them, her house is literally right next to the zone that's being evacuated.
Gosh.
So we've been kind of following that.
But she's hasn't had to evacuate.
Like literally like the house next door.
I spoke to someone yesterday in my other job for a competitor news outlet, and her wedding venue, she's meant to be getting married on Saturday, and her wedding venue thankfully at this stage she doesn't think it's burnt down, but she said that it's probably inhabitable. And they're like trying desperately to find another venue for 150 wedding partiers for this weekend in Nelson. And
good luck. I don't think I'd want to be in.
No.
So all the best.
Maybe you're probably better off just delaying.
She did say, look, at the end of the day, it's just a wedding, it's not my livelihood like so many people, and that's certainly true. Coming up on the show today, of course it is a packed show because it's the Tuesday Wire. News Hub had their first political poll of the year last night. It showed National falling well below Labor and brought bad news for Simon Bridges, but was it hyped just a bit too much? I talk about the science of television political polls with the spin-off's Duncan Grieve. Then we're back to Europe to chat to our correspondent Justin Wong in Paris. This week, Theresa May's been in Brussels, and why do France and Italy seem to hate each other at the moment? After that, we've got the Green Desk. This week, Mitchell speaks to Auckland Council's water manager Andrew Chin about Auckland's Lake Pupiki. Then Liv talks to Family Planning's nurse advisor Laura Ingram about misconceptions surrounding contraception. And finally, for our weekly international segment, Lisa reports on the upcoming elections in Nigeria. Now, as usual, I would absolutely love to hear what you have to say. You know how desperate I am for any form of attention on this show. He aha o whakaro. Get in touch with any thoughts you have. Did you watch last night's political poll on TV3? Was it the explosive poll that they built it up to be? Is this the end for Simon Bridges, or who do you think should be the leader of the National Party? I'm sure, I know it's BFM, but I'm sure we have at least a couple of National supporters listening. So, tuku patu mai, you can text me on 5395. Why am I? Call us in studio on 309 3879 or tweet us at 95BFM News. Plus, Brexit, what are your thoughts? And we're talking about contraception. I'm probably not the right person to be talking about it, but Liv and Lisa will be chatting a bit about it later in the show, and I'll be listening and learning, as is my job here. So give me your thoughts on any of that. Also, on our Twitter account, we have our weekly poll. The question today is, do you pay attention to political polls? That's coming up very shortly on Poll Position. All of this is still to come this hour on The Wire.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Last night, News Hub released its first Reed Research political poll for 2019. It saw National plunge to its worst result in a decade, and it saw Judith Collins rise up above Simon Bridges in the preferred PM stake. Plus, can anybody tackle Jacinda Ardern? She's shot up even further, and so has her party. But one thing stood out to me about last night's poll, and that was how it was presented. Gone was any chance of neutrality. The poll was presented so dramatically and so editorialised, kind of felt like I was watching news being made before the poll had even revealed anything. And that's exactly what was happening, with the poll being hyped by journos on Twitter a day in advance of it even being released, and numerous op-eds coming since online. I spoke to the spin-off's Duncan Grieve about whether polls are becoming too much of an event, and started by asking him whether they even matter nowadays.
I think polls have increased in their importance as they've decreased in their frequency. Historically there were polls every 2-3 weeks. Staff had one, the Herald had one. MediaWorks and TVNZ had their own that they were running quite frequently. The cost of them and the power state of the media means that they don't happen very often. And so as a result, A, you have to justify the investment by really whipping them up into something. And B, their infrequency means they're sort of, they just echo louder and land harder. So you really, I sort of understand why they go so hard with them. And I do think they have a disproportionate impact on parties and people watching politics because they are so infrequent now.
Are they still important? I mean, we're 18 months out from an election. Like you say, they don't happen all the time anymore. Does it actually matter what the poll revealed?
I mean, it doesn't in a vacuum. You know, you obviously, if everyone were to just hold their nerve, the reality is that the election is 18 months away. But there is clearly dissatisfaction within National about Bridges' numbers. Judith Collins extremely wants to be leader. And the other thing is that, you know, the style, News Hub style when it comes to politics, which was really founded by Garner and amplified by Gower and is now being continued by Tova, it's heavily editorialized, and there is a very kind of tangible desire for their reporting and their polls and their pronouncements to have a, not just report the news, but to have an impact on it, especially when it comes to politics. So the most obvious example of this was actually not a MediaWorks poll, but it was the Comar Brunton TVNZ poll that effectively unseated Andrew Little. And the irony being that Corinne Dan is probably the most mild-mannered political editor that either of the networks have had in a long time. But it was their poll, and his interview with Little, where he sort of effectively admitted that he would be considering his options, that led to that, to Ardern's elevation. And I think both the networks adore that as an outcome. Old school media people might find that quite distasteful, but you understand why being able to say our poll changed the world, changed politics, is something that's quite a powerful thing to be able to articulate.
Yeah, and it does seem like they're so editorialised and opinionated, like you said. I mean, I got at least two push notifications from the one poll. I've seen opinion pieces this morning calling it an earthquake poll and all these, you know, big words. It's a doozy. I mean, are they going too hard on it?
I think this was, by the standards of recent polls, it warrants major trailing and amplification, because the polls have been so benign for so long. You know, you've had, broadly speaking, National marginally ahead of Labor, Bridges, you know, in the sort of 5 to 10 range, but and no clear rival apart from Collins rattling around at the bottom. Because you had Labor ahead for the first time in 12 years in the Reed Research poll, that is significant. The fact of Collins overtaking Bridges when Ardern's overtaking Little, had such an impact last time, you couldn't ignore that sort of symmetry. I think you can always argue that calling an earthquake and all the rest of it, but to me that, you know, is too much. But to me that's kind of, that's a style critique. I think the poll was probably the most interesting to the political nerdosphere since since that poll before the election that showed Little down and the Greens way up, and you know, ended up leading to Ardern's elevation.
And it seems like in this sort of news landscape we're in, that
you do need a way to make people sit down and watch. I mean, it did work for me. I made sure that I was there to watch at 6 o'clock because pretty much every News Hub journalist was telling me to on Twitter. Is this a way of trying to sustain traditional news media to get people actually interested?
It certainly is that. It's very hard in a 24-hour news cycle to have something that is saved up to sort of bomb out at 6 p.m. I mean, you saw that most distastefully with the Roastbusters interview. But it's normally the news gets out and all you're doing is kind of contextualising it. It's rare to have an exclusive that you can keep in the bag. But a poll does retain that power. And because of the cost, you have to go hard with it. The other thing is, MediaWorks, the 6 p.m. bulletins are just incredibly important. You just can't overstate their importance to these companies. And One's performance there has been extraordinary. Like, it's the last great ratings monster is One 6 p.m. news. And so many great things for that network flow out of the fact that they have this incredible leader. And if Three can, by whether it's by going more tabloid or, you know, gussying up some of their scoops, start to eat into that, to say, yes, they might have the flash studio and be the kind of broadcaster of record, but we have got the scandals, then their whole night is elevated and they're going to make more money as a result.
Yeah, that is true. One News just sort of chugs along doing its own thing and yet always seems to dominate, doesn't it? But this whole idea of tabloid, I mean, it seems a little bit American, a bit, you know, like how Trump will tweet something out, there'll be this big announcement before something's even happened, even if there's nothing to substantiate it.
It's definitely something which I think a generation of New Zealanders and a generation of journalists will find sort of sticks in their craw. And you see News Hub journalists in particular, Tova, being attacked over some of the presentation stuff, which I think is largely unfair. It's a stylistic decision. Sometimes they overstep it, but I think for the most part, it's kind of consistent tonally, and it becomes a matter of taste, you know, and it probably isn't what I would choose in a vacuum, but I find it more stimulating and fun to watch than One's product, which is actually better resourced, because it does get that higher rating. And so I understand why they do it. I understand why it pisses some people off as well. I guess that for MediaWorks, you know, they're owned by private equity. They're perpetually for sale. Like, at a certain point, you just have to pull out all the stops and maybe pay a little bit less attention to the kind of nuanced academic critiques and just try and get some big chunky ratings. And, you know, I think fair play to them on that.
That was Duncan Gree from The Spin-Off talking about political polls and the science of television polls. I would absolutely love to get your thoughts on any of this. Please remember you can flip me a text 5395 or tweet us at 95BFMNews. Keeping with the theme of polls, though...
Freedom of speech, it means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Poll position on The Wire.
Yes, it is poll position, that great time of the week, of course. Our question on Twitter today was, do you pay attention to political polls? As always, the results just flooded in. It's like a tidal wave of people voting in our poll. 19 of you got back to us. 58% say yes, you do pay attention to political polls. 42% say no. Liv, what do you make of that?
I think that's pretty expected. It seems actually almost 50-50 there, isn't it?
Do you pay attention?
I would say I do try and look at them, but not put too much faith into them because it's all kind of just based on time and place. I mean, even if we look at way back in the Trump election, all the polling,
exactly,
he'll never be president, and then bam.
And there were a lot more polls in America than here. I mean, we're 18 months out. This is the first TV3 poll of the year. Do they matter, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always interesting to see what people are thinking at this point in time, but I think it may be a little bit too soon to be reading so significantly into it, like we've seen in a lot of other media outlets which seem to be doing that.
And that kind of plays into what we're talking about. I mean, do you, being a serious journalist, of course, what are your thoughts on the sort of editorialising or dramatising of a poll?
I think that, especially this early on, I'm not too sure about how I would be personally wanting to do that kind of thing. Editorializing. I think it's hard to remain unbiased as a news source because we're still, like, it's hard. You can't be completely objective because we're all people.
And that
people.
Was fairly obvious last night, I found. But I mean, like I said in that interview, or like Duncan said in that interview, I mean, it was, compared to some of the polls we've had, it was quite dramatic.
I think that
seeing
it was a
national
little bit,
that low.
Oh my gosh, like, everything's, it's catastrophe kind of, it was a lot, I thought.
One of the questions I was tossing up on doing instead of paying attention was about the future of the National Party's leadership. Do you think Simon Bridges is going to be leading the party into the next election?
I honestly can't say that.
No,
yet.
I can't either.
I don't feel, I could actually.
Because there's been so many opportunities for him to stand down already and he's still there.
So.
And the party, despite their polling dropping as a party, 41% is still very high for a party in opposition.
Yeah, I think that saying that 41% means that, you know, it's over for Simon Bridges is a lot. I'm not too sure about why that kind of approach has been taken so dramatically by the other media.
We've had a couple of texts in about the national leadership. One text said Chuck Norris for National Party leader.
Oh, yeah?
That'd be a great choice. Surely he'd have the Ardern factor. Someone has said they're not a National Party voter, but Amy Adams or Todd McClay would be the least controversial choices for me, but I'm not part of their base, so that might be irrelevant. Mm. Would find it especially worrying if Judith Collins became leader after her tweeting and then defending that BS article about age consent laws in France. Post-truth politics is terrifying and I don't want it to become more normalised in New Zealand. I think that's a fairly... I mean, I find something quite alluring about Crusher Collins and the prospect of her becoming leader, but I think that's... that particular argument is fair enough. And someone said, to be fair, I don't know much about Todd McClay, which is why he seems uncontroversial. Oh, that might be, I think that's the same texter. True. I mean, it's whether National wants to go with someone uncontroversial and ride along safe, or whether they want to find someone that they think can dig into Jacinda's, you know, how popular she is with the general public.
Bring someone up who's quite, more controversial, I guess, against what Jacinda's standing for. So I guess time will tell.
Time will tell. If anyone has any thoughts, of course, 5395 is the number, or tweet us at 95BFM News. That was Poll Position.
It's called Democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Poll Position on The Wire.
It's time now to take a quick break on The Wire. Up next, it's time to head to Paris with our correspondent, Justin Wong.
Bang Bang China Cafe, your late-night dumpling lover's dream. All the thrills and flavours of Dominion Road and, well, China, squashed into the only place in the viaduct with zero ocean views. A gut-sizzling range of shumai, potsticker dumplings, steamed buns, dan-dan noodles and utterly delicious loads more. For a quick dumpling fix or late-night karaoke shenanigans, head to Bang Bang China Cafe. Open 7 days from 6 till midnight. Enter via St. Alice next to Dr. Rudy's in the viaduct.
Whoa, Cole.
Can I help you?
Cocktails and test tubes, even cooler than teapots. I'll try this one.
So that's highly poisonous. Secure the body.
Science, it's all good, but just to be safe, why not stay up to date with the latest happenings, discoveries and hot button topics with Dear Science. Every Wednesday Wire on the B, Lillian is joined by a rotating roster of boffins, brainiacs and badasses to make sense of just about bloody everything. Dear Science, every Wednesday Wire on 95BFM, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Welcome back to The Wire. Thanks for tuning in. I've never heard myself on an ad. That was kind of weird.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
It's time now to head to Paris for our regular European catch-up. This week, we're talking to Justin Wong, who is in Paris.
Hello, it actually worked this time.
Yes.
I wonder why that is.
Come on. I know, but but it's not showing a New Zealand number. It's showing, it's 49. Let me think what it is. Yeah, it's showing a German number on my phone.
All right, well, now you know that it's actually me. I am secretly in Germany right now. Now, we're about 45 days or so out from the Brexit deadline. Can you just tell me what's actually been making headlines in the last week?
Yep, so the big headlines last week is not in London, but in Brussels, because Donald Tusk, who is the president of the European Council, says last week there might be a, quote, special place in hell for those Brexiteers promoting Brexit and without a plan on how to deliver it. After Tusk met with the Irish Prime Minister in Brussels. Yes, so afterwards, it's not surprising that in London, especially on the Leave camp, Brexiteers are furious. The Conservative Party's House of Commons leader, Andrea Leadsom, says Tusk should apologise for his, quote, disgraceful and spiteful comments, while former Brexit Secretary David Davis says Tusk might want to, quote, join us there.
Quotes are great by Tusk. That's an amazing quote. It's a special place in hell.
Yeah, it's a special place in hell. And, yeah, quite a lot of what I saw on Twitter is that quite a lot of Remain supporters in London, in the UK, in Britain, they're, like, applauding their quote because, there isn't, like, really a plan for all those, in my view, for the past 900 days when they were discussing all the finer details on how to actually get out of the European Union. Yeah.
And Theresa May's been in Brussels, hasn't she, this week?
For the past week? She has been in Brussels. And
surely that can't have gone too well for her.
Yeah, so what I would say is May didn't get any progress when she was in Brussels last week because she went to see Donald Tusk and the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. And what Juncker and Tusk is just keep reiterating the EU's current official position. There is no renegotiation of the Brexit deal. That means the Irish backstop that is being proposed, that is on the table right now, is not negotiable. It can't be changed. But yeah, for the coming week, the British government is sending their Brexit secretary to Strasbourg to meet with MEPs and its Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt to Paris to talk to people in the European system to convince them that some things can be altered, but for now, the official EU line maintains that the backstop will remain there and there is no change any sort of way.
So I saw quite a lot of commentary ahead of May's visit that no progress would actually be made, and you said that that is in fact what happened. So what's been a lot of the commentary from the media or from people on social media about what's happened in the last week, considering that there's actually been no progress made? Yeah.
In London, it's quite a lot of people are discussing about that, but I don't think I'm the best one to, like, comment on that because I'm, not really engaged to it. But, most of the Brexit commentary are just, like, limited to a couple of paragraphs on the French daily newspapers and all the front pages. Most of the front pages aren't even discussing what's happening in London or in Brussels.
And now that Theresa May is back in the UK, apparently she's going to be addressing her MPs today. Do we have any ideas what she might be talking about?
I think Theresa May is staying in London for the rest of this week because she is due to give a statement at the House of Commons tomorrow, London time, because we are still in Monday evening, to convince more MPs to support her deal. But there are speculation out of London that Theresa May and a small bunch of leading conservative Brexiteers are willing to make some changes to the Irish backstop. Like there is speculation that Boris Johnson, who is a leading Brexiteer, that he might be willing to change his stance from allowing no backstop whatsoever to allow a time-limited backstop. That means it might be, a time-limited backstop.
So, that's interesting. So there's actually, you think, a chance that she might be able to persuade some more people to support her deal?
Yes. And with less than 50 days to go, I personally think that Westminster, Downing Street, they're now feeling the heat, whatever you're a Remainer or a Brexiteer. This has to be done and dusted by some point, otherwise it's going to be in the UK's case, it's going to be very messy.
And surely Theresa May will still be dealing with a lot of animosity within her, within the House of Commons and within her own party. She's still not popular.
Even though she's not popular, I would say this has been dropped a little bit. In fact, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, he sent a letter to the Prime Minister last Wednesday, I think, outlining his five demands, and including, and let me just find that, you can cut that out, and included five demands such as a customs union with the EU, the UK will remain aligned with the single markets, and a bunch of other stuff that relates to workers' rights and protections. But I personally think the tone of the letter is not like, I demand you to resign right now and have a general election, and I want to talk. And what the reply from Theresa May the day after is not like going hard on reiterating her red lines. That means no extension of Article 50, no customs union, no single market whatsoever. And it's like, the tone of it is like extending an olive branch to the opposition, to the Labour Party, to the SNP, or maybe the other parties in Westminster, to say, look, I want to talk because really we shouldn't be having a general election, right? We shouldn't be having an argument of the government should resign. We just want to get this done.
And moving away from Brexit, France and Italy are having a bit of a spat.
Yes, so Paris have recalled its ambassador in Rome for the first time since 1940. After a couple of really publicised spats with Rome between President Emmanuel Macron and leaders of the Italian government. So here's a little bit of context first before going on. Italy's the current Italian government is a populist coalition that was elected in May. It is consisted of a coalition of seven parties and led by political parties that are strongly anti-immigration, such as the League and the Five Star Movement. The current Italian populist government was elected in May last year. Just 1 month later, French President Emmanuel Macron openly criticised Rome after the Italians refused the Aquarius, which is a ship with 630 migrants on board that it rescued in the Mediterranean to dock in Italian shores. And what he said, and what Macron said in the decision, how Macron criticised the Italians was, quote, "I only take lessons from those who open his ports." And one of the Italian deputy prime ministers, let me find his name, Matteo Salvini, who was also the leader of one of the anti-immigration parties of the coalition, the League, demanded an apology and called Macron arrogant. So, yeah, that's, yeah, so the spat doesn't, like, originated recently. It's already, it started, like, far in the year before. But what really triggered this incident that France recalled its ambassador back from Rome is during the Gilets Jaunes movement, because in early January, the government in Rome openly supported the French Gilets Jaunes movement, with Salvini describing the protesters as, quote, "honest citizens." And they, he also criticized Macron as not up to expectations, and he is governing against his own people. And just last week, the other deputy prime minister of Italy, Luigi Di Maio, who is the leader of the Five Star Movement, invited several Gilets Jaunes protesters who are intending to run for European parliamentary elections in upcoming May. And Lelice just decided this is too much, and they recalled their minister. But, yeah, and this is involved a lot. Yeah, this involves a lot about the European elections in the coming May. But, yeah, I'm going to analyse it more further and talk to you about it next week.
We'll talk again next week, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about. There's always so much going on over in that part of the world. Thank you very much, though.
Yeah, especially Europe.
Yeah, exactly. All right, talk soon.
Yeah. Right.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
That was Justin Wong in Paris. He's filling in for Mary Margaret this week and next, talking about everything going on in Europe. Some really interesting stuff there. I kind of had no idea about the Paris and Italy stuff, so we'll be following that closely. Something else that we've been talking a lot this morning about is, of course, New Zealand politics, with that poll from News Hub last night. One of the things that poll showed was that Judith Collins was ahead of Simon Bridges in the preferred Prime Minister poll. She was on 6.2% while Bridges is on 5%. This morning, Judith Collins told reporters that she's not interested in the role of opposition leader. She said the person that she's most pleased with beating is Winston Peters. Opposition leader is the toughest job in politics. That she's not actually interested in it. I don't know. Do we buy that? She's unsuccessfully run for the party leadership before. Why would she not want it now? So I think that she's just giving that kind of typical political answer, isn't she? We'll be following that, seeing what comes of it.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
This week on the Green Desk, Mitchell speaks to Auckland Council's water manager Andrew Chin about Auckland's Lake Pupeke. There are concerns regarding a potential toxic algae bloom in Lake Pupeke, which could have serious implications for the health of the lake, its users and its biodiversity. The Auckland Council have recently applied for a resource consent to place flocculants. What's a flocculant? In Lake Pupeke, in case a toxic algae bloom does occur. Mitchell begins by asking Mr. Chin about toxic algae blooms, what they are and how they form.
A toxic algal bloom is one where the algal species is dominated by blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, and that type of algae has toxins in it which can, you know, basically make people ill. It can give you diarrhea or gastroenteritis, and it can also make dogs and other animals sick as well.
So does that mean, I'm not sure if there is aquatic life in Pupeke at the moment, but does that mean it's all going pretty much?
Well, no, so at the moment there's an algal bloom happening in Lake Pupeke, but it's not a toxic algal bloom.
Okay.
It's a different species that's dominating, But the problem is that in the warm weather, the lake, what we call stratifies, all the warm water accumulates at the top and the cold water sinks to the bottom. And then the cold water at the bottom of the lake starts to go anoxic or starved of oxygen. And in those conditions, more nutrients are released from the sediments, which then increases the risk of more algal bloom. And there's another thing happening is the algal bloom blocks the sunlight on the surface.
Of course.
So the big plants, like the eelgrass, start to die because they don't get enough sunlight. They die, float to the surface, start to rot and add to the nutrients. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
Sounds like it. So how much more of a rise are we going to need, or like not going to need, but is it going to take for this toxic algal bloom to take shape?
Look, it's not necessarily related to the temperature. What we're just seeing is the risk factors start to increase. Whether or not the cyanobacteria starts to bloom or not, it's anyone's guess. It's monitoring it and checking. We could be lucky in the conditions, even though if it gets hotter, cyanobacteria might not start to dominate, but we just have to keep a very close eye on it.
I mean, does the fact that it's an urban lake with, you know, humans around it, human activity happening, is that having an effect on it? Is any of those kind of activities having an impact on it as well as temperature?
Well, obviously, there's the urban runoff contains a lot of toxins, but to be honest, it's probably not as nutrient-loaded as rural runoff. You know, the types of algal blooms that we're seeing are happening sort of down south in the Waikato, near Pekafora, Taumutu at the moment. But Lake Pupuki, we're sort of lucky that it's a very big and deep lake, and so there's a lot of water in there. So we've been quite lucky that we haven't had a cyanobacteria bloom in Lake Pupuki yet.
Right. And for those other places, you were talking about the Waikato and stuff,
yep.
Has there been any mitigation? Is there a way to remedy this once it's happened?
Oh, yes, there are a number of interventions that you can do. So, for example, in some locations, they try to stop that stratification happening. They aerate the lake to get it mixing so you don't have those anoxic conditions at the bottom. Another, and obviously, like in around the Bay of Plenty, Rotorua, there's long-term interventions to try and minimise the amount of nutrient that runs off from agricultural land uses. So that's a huge program and a long-term program to try and better control the land uses so that you don't get the phosphorus and the nitrogen coming off and coming into the freshwater body.
Right. And I saw now, Pupuki, you guys are wanting to put in flocculants. What actually is a flocculant? What's it actually going to achieve for Pupuki?
Okay, so it's a precautionary measure that will hold off only if there is a cyanobacteria bloom. So what a flocculant does, and a lot of people will be familiar with this if they've got a swimming pool. If your swimming pool is cloudy, you'll often add a flocculant that'll cause all of the fine particles to flock together, and then they sink, and the lake becomes clearer at the surface. So essentially, if we get a cyanobacteria outbreak, one of the things that we could do is add the flocculant to cause all of those microscopic algae to flock together and then sink to the bottom.
So
clarifying the lake, if you like.
Yeah, so that's not no form of like actual remediation. That's just like a sort of short-term...
It's treating a symptom, it's not treating the cause.
Right, and just going back to Waikato and stuff, what those other places that have had these algal blooms, what has it meant for sort of everything in there? Has there been a drop-off in all life and things like that? And
it does. Look, algal blooms definitely upset the ecosystem of the lake. You start to get a dominance of one species. You can get the fish and other life in the lake being affected. So you've got the lakes that were recently listed by the Waikato Regional Council were Lake Naroto, Taumutu, Waikiri and Pekafora, and Whangati and Huntly.
Yeah.
And the key thing is, under the water quality, when you get those algal blooms, you've got to put up no swimming notices and warn people not to swim in the lake. And of course, we know that Lake Pupuki is a very popular recreational lake, so that's why we want to keep it really close to our nose.
Would you think that, obviously there's different scenarios for this, but if it was to take a turn for the worse, it would potentially, you'd have to cordon it off kind of thing?
It's monitored by our Safe Swim website, so we'd put up the warning signs. We wouldn't be able to fence it off, if you like. It's not practical, but we'd definitely
change the notices on the Safe Swim website and warn people about the risk. But it's not there yet, and it's not where, and it may not happen. We're just trying to give everyone some early warning that the risk factors are increasing and it may happen.
Of course, yeah. So just one question. Is there any possible way that, you know, locals and people who use it can do things to sort of help it?
Well, it's a very complex problem. For locals, it's probably watching what you put down the drain. It's not a very large catchment, but obviously the suburban garden, so you don't want people overusing or putting fertiliser in particular down their drain.
Yep.
The issues in Lake Pukia complex, there's been introduced pest species, perch in particular, that in their juvenile state has been eating a lot of the plants and upsetting the natural balance. So we really want the right plants in the lake to minimise the amount of nutrients. And so we get a domination of those small microscopic floating algae that block the sunlight, that exacerbates the problem.
Okay. So do you think, if it, say it was to continue the way it is going now, is there sort of a time frame or a time limit on like when it would maybe become unsafe? Say there was no mitigation that happens?
You couldn't put a time limit whether it turns. So like I say, the conditions are right for an algal bloom. There is an algal bloom there at the moment. It's just not a toxic algal bloom.
Okay.
So whether or not it shifts to a different species is really what we're keeping an eye on.
Right. No, thank you for that. That's about all the questions I've got. Did you want to add anything else yourself?
Probably, yeah. Auckland Council's going to be launching a discussion document in February around all the water issues and water quality in particular. It's starting a development of a water strategy for Auckland. So it's not just Lake Pupuki, obviously, but we've got our harbours, beaches, our aquifers and marine areas that we've... There's a lot of concern about our water quality and the amount of water available to use for irrigation and the like. So over the months of February and March, this discussion document will be published and made public, and we really encourage people to have a look and put your feedback if it's an issue that they find dear to their hearts.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was The Green Desk. We will have another instalment for you next week. I'm just glad that story told me what a flocculant was, because isn't that just a great word? Flocculant.
Great word.
Flocculant. Say it at home if you're listening.
Flocculant.
We've had a couple of texts in about Judith Collins running for the national, or whether she might be in the running for national leadership. Someone texted in and said Judith is the New Zealand equivalent of Trump, which... I don't know if I buy that, because aren't they kind of opposites in the sense that Judith is like a creation of politics, whereas Trump is supposedly this anti-political figure who's come into the role?
Yeah, I guess, people are thinking their thing. I don't really...
That is the analysis that people tune into BFM for. People are thinking their things. And someone else just said outright that she wants to be leader. I'd be really interested. I know I said this earlier, but if there is... any national supporters who listen to BFM, if there's anyone...
Have we got any texts in?
No, we've had a text in specifically saying I'm not a national voter. So if there's anyone out there who's a national supporter, please text, and I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on this poll. Something else that's caught my attention from around